Good morning, everyone. How is everyone doing today? So. Right, let's begin then, shall we? All right, let's put our palms together then in veneration of the great master, our teacher and our guide, reminding ourselves that it is in his footsteps that we follow and we walk to the destination that he has so clearly proclaimed and laid down for us. This is the only path that there exists to ultimate bliss, to an unconditional happiness. And as we make this veneration, let us also renew our pledge of allegiance to the Noble Triple Gem and renew our oath to practice the Dhamma for now and forever, to free ourselves from the shackles of suffering and to help all others who cross paths with us along the way. Let us chant the Namaskara and observe the precepts before we begin today's sermon.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
I'm aware that we have an increasing, a growing population of non-Buddhists in our audience. Who is a Buddhist and who is a non-Buddhist? If I can claim that I am not a Buddhist monk, how can you be any more Buddhist than I am? I am not a Buddhist monk. I'm just a Buddhist monk. I mean that in very different senses. What is it to be Buddhist? If you understand physics, people will call you a physicist. If you understand chemistry, people will call you a chemist. If you understand biology, people will call you a biologist. If you understand science, just general science, or computer science, they'll call you a computer scientist. If you understand the truth about the world, they'll call you, I don't know, you say, whatever it is. See, sometimes a question I get, and this is a very valid question, and I like questions like this because I always want to try and create, as much as you do, and I think that is what we've all managed to do here, create a very inclusive environment. We don't segregate here. Whether you're man or woman, black or white, whatever religion or faith you believe in, none of that matters here. As you walk through those doors, as far as I'm concerned, you're just a human being. And I don't think anyone will deny that. See, if I ask the Buddhists in the room to put their hands up, those who identify themselves as Buddhists might put their hand up. If I ask the Christians to put their hand up, then a few of you will do. If I ask the Muslims to do, then some of you will do. If I ask the Hindus to do, some of you will do. If I ask the atheists to do, then some others, yet others will do, and so on. If I ask what your religion is, what your race is, what background you come from, what nationality you are, to all this you have an answer. And these are the things that typically segregate us. They label us. They put us into little boxes. And what happens when that happens is we tend to forget that behind all that underneath all that, we have something in common, and that is we are all humans. A human is merely a body and a mind. But a mind that has the ability, a mind that is capable of understanding a higher truth, to put it quite simply, to free itself from suffering, that's all. You're never going to come across a dog or a cow or any other four-legged beast that can free itself from suffering. It won't know how to do it. No matter how many sermons you give it, it's never going to understand that. You can preach till the cows come home, but those cows are not going to understand how to free themselves from suffering. They're far too preoccupied dealing with the sufferings that they feel physically. Hunger is their biggest problem. That is not to say that they don't fear. They don't feel fear. They do. They do feel fear. They do feel sorrow. They do feel grievance. They do feel all these things. They feel greed. But they have no way of coming out of any of those things. They're stuck in their own ways. Because of the deeds that they have done, today they have been born in what we call the four great hells, and that is quite literally a hell because there is no escape now. There is no escape from the mental torment that they have to go through. That is the main and the biggest difference between them and us. As human beings, ladies and gentlemen, you have the freedom of choice. What's more importantly, you have the choice of freedom. You can make the choice of freedom. Today, if you're suffering because of whatever reason, you don't have to be that way. You can choose to come out of it. For instance, if you're afraid of something, if you're scared of something, if you're worried about something, say someone in your family has been diagnosed with something terminal. Let's say an aunt, a brother, a sister, God forbid your mother, your father, has been diagnosed with a terminal illness. Someone's got the terminal illness, you also got an illness. Your illness is the illness of fear. Your illness is the illness of worry. Someone else has got the cancer, but you also got a cancer. That is the cancer of the mind. So you take the patient to the doctor. You get them scanned, you take biopsies, do all sorts of checks to try and find out if it is possible to treat it. And then they start a course of treatment that could take months, maybe years. And chances are, there's a chance that it can be healed. Maybe it's chemotherapy, some other treatment. Chances are, you know, over a course of that treatment, they can be healed. But what about the fear that you have? The fear that something untoward might happen. The fear of losing someone you love. Once the cancer is gone, is that gone as well? Say your mother's got a cancer. You love her dearly. Who doesn't? Of course, everyone does. The moment you find out about this, now you're scared, you're afraid of losing her, right? So you take her to the best doctors in the world. They examine her, they treat her. 3 years after her cancer first appeared, they actually treat her. And now the cancer's gone. No sign of cancer. She's given some medication. She has to take it for the rest of her life, but she's fine. She'll outlive the cancer, let's just say. So you were scared, you were worried, you were really worried of losing her. 3 years on from that, now the cancer's gone. Is your fear gone? Fear of losing her? Is it? I'll tell you what's happened. Your fear of losing her out of that cancer is gone. But your fear of losing her has not gone. It's still there with you. It's still there. So you keep taking her to the doctor. Every 6 months you go and do a checkup. Initially she had a cancer in her left lung. Now you realize she has it in her right lung. 6 months after her last treatment. What happened to the fear? It's back again. So the cancer was treated, but the fear, that's still there. Let's say the cancer doesn't come back and she lives for the rest, remainder of her life free of cancer. But of course, you can't stop age. You can't stop people aging, and eventually you know that she's going to pass away. What about the fear of losing her? The fear of death? That's not gone. See, don't you think that there's a bigger problem that people have than what seems on the outside? Superficially, people think that terminal illnesses, these are the greatest tragedies that people have to go through. But I dare say, no, they're not. Because you can treat a cancer at the best hospital in the world, but you can't treat the fear of losing someone. The fear of getting a cancer, the fear of losing someone to cancer. You can't get rid of that unless you take the Dhamma. The Dhamma is the only refuge. There is nothing Buddhist about that, ladies and gentlemen. When you are here and we observe the five precepts, first we took refuge in the Noble Triple Gem. Previous to that, I asked you all to put your hands together and pay veneration to the Buddha. Still, for many of you, the Buddha may be an individual who lived 2,500 years ago. Conventionally, yes, that is true. When we say the word Buddha, it represents an individual who lived 2,500 years ago. But here's what we sometimes tend to forget. The Bodhisattva became the Buddha. He was a Buddha aspirant. Just think about that for a second. I'm giving you food for thought. Just think about this for a second. The Bodhisattva was a Buddha aspirant, wasn't he? So for four incalculable eons, it is said, he strived to become a Buddha. If he strived to become a Buddha, then he is not the Buddha, is he? He strived to become a Buddha. So the concept of Buddha was always there. He strived to become the Buddha. It's like doctor. Who's a doctor? Are you a doctor or did you just become one? See, the doctor is not an individual. It's a position. It's an ability. It's a recognition of an ability. It's the recognition of perhaps some authority. The power to do something. That is what a doctor is. A doctor is not an individual. So let's just say we have, in all of Sri Lanka, let's say we had 1,000 doctors, just for argument's sake. Right? They had 1,000 doctors and all the medical schools shut down. No more doctors being trained. So when the last doctor dies, we have no more doctors in the land. Yeah? Don't worry, this is a hypothetical situation. You know, something similar happened with higher ordination, Upasampada. Many years ago in Sri Lanka, the last higher ordained monk, when he passed away, then higher ordination or Upasampada was no longer available on this land. And then we had to import it from Burma. So if the last doctor dies, now can there no longer be any doctors? Are we never going to have any more doctors? Are we never going to have any more doctors because all of the doctors have died? No, of course we can. All we got to do is to reopen those med schools, start tuition again, and 5 years on from the first intake, you have a doctor. What does that tell you? A doctor is not an individual. A doctor is not an individual. It's a position. It's a position that one can aspire to. If you instill the values of a doctor, if you take on the knowledge of a doctor, if you train as a doctor, if you practice as a doctor, then that is what a doctor is. It's not an individual. Do you get the concept I'm trying to put across to you, ladies and gentlemen? So then what is a Buddha? It is not an individual. It is simply someone who has understood the truth about the world. That's it. Isn't that why, once the truth is no longer among us, now a bodhisattva, which is all of us, a bodhisattva aspires to understand the truth, comprehend the truth. The difference between all of us and a Sammasambuddha, a supreme Buddha, is he has no teacher. So he is entirely reliant on his merits. That's why it takes him an awfully long time to engage in all sorts of merits and make incredible amounts of sacrifice to eventually discover the Noble Eightfold Path once again. And in doing so, he qualifies, just as a medical student qualifies as a doctor, a bodhisattva qualifies as a Buddha. That what that must tell you is, a Buddha is not an individual. So when we put our hands together and we said, Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasa, it is not an individual who lived 2,500 years ago, we worship. This is between you and I, okay? This is for the intellectuals. You know, the Buddha should be the last person to claim that he was a self, right? Just think about it for a second. If he were to say that I am the Buddha and no one else is the Buddha, you must all respect me and worship me, 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 and me, he has not even become a Sotapanna yet, let alone a Buddha. I mean, the Buddha is going to be the last person to say that it is I who is the Buddha. Yes, in the Tripitaka you will find instances where the Buddha claims, yes, I am the Buddha. But he means it in a very different sense to what most people understand. Most people think what he says is, I am the Buddha, I am the Buddha. No one else is the Buddha, I am the Buddha. Worship me. He uses the word ahang, yes, which is Pali for me. But what he refers there, what he refers to there, is his chitta, the mind. Because he of all people understands that he is an aggregation of mind and matter. As a bodhisattva, his mind aspired to instill the values and the virtues and the knowledge that was required to elevate itself to the state of Buddha. That is why it's called Buddhahood. So we're not worshipping an individual. We don't bring our hands together to worship an individual. When you worship your mother and your father, does it have their names in the gatha? Dasamase urekatva, posesi uttikaranam, somalata ayudigam. Because her name is Somalata. Does it? Tell me, does it? No, it doesn't. Because it is not a gatha, it is not a stanza to worship an individual. In Buddhist philosophy, we don't worship individuals because there are no individuals to worship. There are virtues, there are qualities. They don't belong to anyone. Who does heat belong to? Heat. Who does heat belong to? Hardness, softness, who do these things belong to? These are characteristics. Kindness, who does kindness belong to? Generousness, who does that belong to? Can anyone claim to say that it belongs to me? So when you chant the Buddha Gunagata, Itipi, so Arahang, Samma Sambuddho, విద్యాచరణ సంపన్నం, సుగతో, లోకవిధు, హూ డు దే బిలాంగ్ టు? ప్రిన్స్ సిద్ధార్థ, ద బుద్ధ గౌతమ, ఓ ద బుద్ధ అనోమదాసి, పర్హాప్స్ ద బుద్ధ విపాసి, పర్హాప్స్ ద మైత్రి బుద్ధ హూస్ యెట్ టు కమ్. హూ డస్ ఇట్ బిలాంగ్ టు? హూ డు దే బిలాంగ్ టు? ద వెరీ క్వశ్చన్ ఈజ్ ఫ్లాడ్. It is only one who has not seen the Buddha who believes that these virtues are virtues of a particular individual. If you bring your hands together and in your veneration you are thinking of the Buddha that lived 2,500 years ago and it is to him you make that veneration, you are yet to see the Buddha. You only see him through your physical eyes, you have yet to see him through your wisdom mind. In the wisdom mind, the Buddha has not passed into Parinibbana. In fact, it would even be wrong to call him, him. What gender is the Buddha? So now you're thinking, were there lady Buddhas? No, the Buddha has no gender. Buddha is enlightenment. Buddha is understanding. Buddha is freedom from suffering. Buddha is happiness. Buddha is ultimate bliss. Buddha is unconditional love. Buddha is limitless compassion. Buddha is boundless. All the good things in the world. That's what Buddha is. Who do they belong to? That's like asking, who does the moon belong to? Who does goodness belong to? You'll say, my grandmother's really good though, Swami Nahansa. But does goodness belong to her? Okay, say your grandmother is very good, is really good. But your grandfather is not so much. But you're trying to make him good. So are you taking something from your grandmother and putting it into your grandfather? So much so that once he becomes good, now your grandmother is less good. Because you've taken something from her and put it into your grandfather? You know that's not how it works. Is it not because these things don't belong to anyone? Anyone among us can become a Buddha? In fact, all of us can become Buddhas. Whose permission do you need to become a Buddha? The Buddha's? Do you think you need his permission to become a Buddha? But if these qualities and virtues actually belong to him, then should you not be asking him, getting his permission to take them from him? And if you didn't do that, wouldn't that be stealing? This was one of the best things that appealed to me in Buddhist philosophy. One of the greatest things that appealed to me. I was no one's servant. I was free to make my own choices. I could become a Buddha if I wanted to. Because a Buddha is not anyone. In Mandarin, the word for Buddha is Pho. It means no man. No man. And that is exactly what Buddha is. It is no man. It is no one. It is virtue. It is understanding. It is comprehension. It is enlightenment. It is freedom. It is bliss. Would you like it? Would you rather that those things belong to someone? What do you say? Happiness belongs to someone. Let's say happiness is in the bank. You have to go make withdrawals whenever you need to. And you have to fill in a withdrawal, what do you call it, voucher. Get it stamped, signed. You have to wait until the bank opens. So there'll be people waiting outside in long queues waiting to withdraw happiness. Would you rather happiness belong to someone just like your money? Would you rather happiness belong to someone? Would you rather that arahang belong to someone? Would you rather that Samma Sambuddha belong to someone? And Vijayacharana Sampanna belong to someone? These things don't belong to anyone. It's like the air we breathe. It doesn't belong to anyone. Therefore, it's available for everyone. So when you put your hands together and you chant, Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasa, see, you don't even say Gautama. Just think about it for a second. You don't make reference to any Buddha, individual, who's lived in the past or any who lives in the future. Namo tassa means you incline yourself towards it. Tell me where in these words you find an individual, and I will walk up and leave, because I've subscribed to the wrong philosophy. I want absolute freedom. I'm not here to be anyone's slave. Least of all, mine. I'm looking for absolute freedom. If that's what you want, I have to offer that to you. Namo tassa. I incline myself. Bhagavato. To great understanding. The understanding that helps look at the world through the lens of Dhamma and therefore understand that all there are in the world are the five aggregates. Bhagavato. Arahato. I incline myself to a practice that helps me to free myself of the cankers, defilements. The defilements that torment me. The defilements that cause suffering. Samma sambuddhassa. To do so, I incline myself to the noble path, to the destination that is Buddha, enlightenment. Now, where in those words did you hear Gautama? Where in those words did you hear an individual's name? Because I understand this, having read a few, spent some time with the Bible, having spent some time with the Holy Quran, having spent some time with the Bhagavad Gita, I understand that in some of these religions, it is forbidden to venerate, to worship an individual. Fair enough. Don't. I would never ask you to. If your religion says that Allah is the greatest one, He is the one, that is what Allah means. One. Four means no one. Allah is the one. If in your religion it is only the great Allah that you can be a servant to, that you can believe in and have faith in, then so be it. You be very devoted to your religion and then do Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. No one. Nothing to fear. This is only a path to freedom. Only a path to bliss. Only a path to unconditional happiness. I'll tell you this much. If Allah is as great as He is claimed to be, that is exactly what He'd want for you. Prove me wrong if you can. If the great God Allah is as great as He claims to be, as people claim to be, then all He'd want for you, His children, is to be unconditionally happy. To walk along a path that takes you to unconditional happiness so that you can always be happy. That's what God would want for you. No? I mean, what good would be a God if He didn't want you, His children, to be happy? If your religion says that God Almighty, He is the Father, and His Son is the Savior, And you must not believe, you must not take refuge in any other individual. I subscribe to that myself. Fair enough. Don't. You continue to be a God-loving Christian. And that's perfectly fine. These two things are not incompatible. Why do I share this with you? I share this with you because among you in the audience, maybe from time to time individuals who might feel that you're going against your religion by being here. You're listening to the Dhamma and it's making sense to you. You're listening to the Dhamma and it's helping you become a better individual. But then in the back of your mind, you have a sense of guilt. You have a guilty conscience that keeps telling you, hey, you're not supposed to be here. You're God's child. If you love God, then you have to be obedient to Him, and He is your shepherd. What are you doing here? Why are you worshipping an individual? I'm simply reminding you that this is Buddhist philosophy. It is not a religion. You're not here to worship anyone. All I lay down for you is the path to happiness. No, you don't even have to chant it. You know, this is a very customary thing. I say, put your hands together in veneration of the Buddha. Buddha is enlightenment. He's not the individual. But there may be some among you who are very devoted Buddhists. And, right, it runs in your blood. You feel you are even more Buddhist than the Buddha. Right? And you're probably thinking, how dare you, Swami Nuhansa? The Buddha is the Buddha is the Buddha. He is my Buddha. I love the Buddha. The Buddha loves me. Fair enough. If that is your religion, then do continue. Let that be your religion. Let Islam be your religion. Let Christianity be your religion. Let Zoroastrianism be your religion. Let Judaism be your religion. I'm not talking about a religion. I'm talking about the science of the mind. I'm not a Buddhist monk. I'm simply a scientist in a robe. That's all. I'm only saying these words to help relieve you of any guilty conscience that you might have at the back of your mind. Thinking, am I supposed to be here? What if the church finds out? What if the mosque finds out? What if the kovil finds out? What if my community finds out? If they find out, you tell them. I only believe in one God, and my God is my God. I'm only there to learn the science of the mind. That's all. And I'm not here to teach you anything more than that either. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi simply, once again, means I take refuge in the destination of happiness. You go on holiday, don't you? When you want to be happy? Well, isn't that a destination of happiness? Don't you do Hawaii saraṇaṃ gacchāmi from time to time? Huh? Or Maldives saraṇaṃ gacchāmi? Singapore saraṇaṃ gacchāmi? See? So what's so bad with Buddha saraṇaṃ gacchāmi then? You have that version, your mundane version of happiness, and I'm here to give you a supramundane version of happiness. Unconditional happiness is Buddha, conditional happiness is Hawaii. Or Barbados. That's conditional happiness. How do you know that's conditional happiness? Because people there are not happy. So they come to Sri Lanka looking for happiness. If happiness were there, then they wouldn't be traveling, would they? We've talked about this before. Happiness is not in Barbados. It is not in the Sahara. It is not in the Niagara Falls. You go looking for it. Let me know when you find it. unconditional happiness is Buddha. That's why you say, Buddhang saranam gacchami. I take unconditional happiness as my refuge. Now, what religion must you be to be that, to do that, to say that? Put aside saying that, you know, it's because it's, the whole thing is about, should I be chanting something like that? And then should I wash my mouth with harpic after I've said that? Right? That's what you're probably thinking, right? I'm such a devout religious man. Right? If I say something like that, I should wash my mouth with soap. Right? Okay, put aside saying that. I'm just saying, you know, in your mind, is it so wrong to take refuge in unconditional happiness? Is there any religion that would forbid that? That wouldn't be a religion then, would it? I take refuge in unconditional happiness. Two, I take refuge in the path to unconditional happiness. Dhammang saranam gacchami. Dhamma is the path. The Noble Eightfold Path, that is the Dhamma. Sanghang saranam gacchami. Ignorance and attachment is what keeps you bound to suffering. Sanghang is to free the mind of ignorance and attachment. That's it. I take refuge and I commit my life to freeing myself from ignorance and attachment. Sanghang saranam gacchami. Now, which religious leader do you think you take refuge in when you see these three things? Which individual? Which personality? Which person? Which character? The answer is Fo. That's the Chinese would put it. Meaning? No one. No one. Then you have the five precepts. Panatipata. I refrain from killing. In fact, there's something more than it's more than I simply refrain from killing. What it actually says is, I observe the precept, meaning I observe the practice of cleansing my mind so that I won't ever have the need to kill. I won't ever be vexed to want to kill. It is far, far more sublime, far more profound than simply not killing. Because there are two kinds of people who don't kill. One, so of the people who want to kill, there are two kinds of people who don't kill. I mean, there's a third kind here, they just don't want to kill. But there are three kinds of people who don't kill, even if they wanted to. One, those who refrain themselves from doing it. They want to do it, but they don't do it because they know it's bad. It's bad. It's bad to kill. It's unmeritorious to kill. It's a sin to kill. I want to kill, but I won't. So when you see a rodent, now you go into the kitchen and you see a rat running behind the fridge, or is running, you open the cupboards and you hear, you know, the rats, then you are reminded of what Swami has said. Sabba sattesu. And he's going, damn it. So then you come the following day and put a chitta or something on here. Swami says, are rats included in sabba sattesu? Because you made a vow that you will always conduct yourself with compassion and loving kindness towards all sentient beings. Sabba sattesu metta sahagatena cetasa viharanam samadhiyami. To always have loving kindness and compassion towards all sentient beings. That is a precept that you now observe. You observe a sixth precept. Just think about it, ladies and gentlemen. Where were you 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago? What were you doing? You were wasting your life. Doing a 9-to-5. Earning some money. Building some property, and it didn't matter to you who you had to hurt. It didn't matter to you who you had to bring down. It didn't matter to you whose legs from which you had to pull them down. It didn't matter. It didn't matter to you who you had to hurt. whose feelings you had to hurt, it didn't matter. You would shout at them, scream at them, yell at them. People were treated like trash. That's who you were. But now, you observe a sixth precept. Just look at where you are today. Today you make a vow. I shall not harm any living being. In fact, it's even more than that. It's not merely I shall not harm any living being, because that is simply to avoid, refrain. This is something you actively do. What do you actively do? I always spread loving kindness and compassion to all sentient beings. Because to refrain from harming is one, but then to actively spread loving kindness and compassion, that's an active thing. That the other is a passive thing. I refrain from. So Panatipata Veramani Sikkhapadang Samadhyami is not simply I refrain from killing. It's not the precept of refraining from killing. It's the precept of practice. Practice such that you are free from vexation, from ignorance and attachment, such that you will never ever want to kill. That's the second kind of person. So there are two kinds of people. One, they don't kill because it's bad, it's a sin. The others don't kill because they don't want to kill. Some don't kill because it's an offense. They get put in prison. They have to pay compensation. There are consequences. But that's not why someone who is a sabba satte sumetta sahagate na cheta sahaviranang samadhi, one who is of that caliber, they don't not kill because it's bad to kill. They don't kill because there's no need to kill. The same goes for the other precepts also. Panatipata adinnadana. You have no need to steal because now you understand that there is nothing in this world that is valuable enough to steal, that is worthy of stealing. Because you have understood that happiness comes from within. If happiness comes from within, why should I steal something that belongs to someone else? Just think about it for a second. Someone you know has something that they believe is precious to them. Let's say it's a ring. A diamond ring. It's very precious to them. When you know that it's precious to them, here's what you also know. That is the object that makes them happy. Meaning, they are yet to find unconditional happiness. Because to them, happiness comes from the ring. But to you, happiness doesn't come from anything. Happiness is within. Now, why would you want to steal it? Now you don't steal it because it's bad to steal. Now you don't steal it because you get in prison. Is that why you don't steal? Or because you realize that happiness does not come from a material object. It is always within me. So if it's always within you, why would you steal? Why would you steal a material object? Why would you steal another man's wife? Why? You wouldn't, but only when you understand that happiness does not come from someone, from something, from another situation. It's not an external thing that can be transported to you. It is within you. And that is why a Buddhist does not steal. So adinnadana veramani sikkhapadang samadhiyami means I observe the practice of the Noble Eightfold Path, which frees my mind of ignorance and attachment. Ignorance that happiness comes from the outside world. Happiness comes from doing things. Happiness comes from abhisankara. Happiness is something I have to go and fish for. Happiness is something I have to go and shop for. Happiness is something I have to go and hunt for. This is the mindset of a prithakjana, an ignoble person. They believe that happiness is always a step ahead of them. So they're always on a constant what race? Rat race. Always happiness is one step ahead of them. That is what they think. They consider themselves a donkey, where the carrot is always 1 foot ahead of them. You know, the analogy or the metaphor of the donkey and the carrot is so fitting. Because the carrot is tied to the donkey, isn't it? Meaning, the carrot is already belongs to the donkey, doesn't it? It's tied to the donkey. But because it is hung a yard away from it, a foot away from it, this donkey, being a donkey, thinks that it has to proceed, go forth to acquire this carrot, when it's already in its possession. Now tell me about happiness. Where is happiness? In which supermarket do they sell it? Which aisle number? Is it in the alcoholic beverages aisle? Is it in the frozen desserts aisle? Is it in the confectionery aisle? Or the bakery aisle? Which aisle do you spend most of your time as you walk into the on your way home? Looking for happiness? Can you hear me? I'm speaking to you. I'm speaking to you, my dear people. I'm speaking to you. I'm speaking to the mothers and the fathers of my past. Not again, though. I won't let you be a mother to me again. I won't let you be a father to me again. That's it, enough. You've suffered enough on my behalf. Now it's time you smile on my behalf. I made you shed countless tears in this journey of samsara. Not again. From here on my behalf, you will only shed tears of one kind, and those are tears of joy. I did not have the Dhamma when I first met you. Long, long, long time ago. I didn't have the Dhamma then. So I'd have walked up to you, I would have looked up at you and said, I want this, I want that, I want the other, give it to me, give it to me, give it to me. And if you didn't give it to me, I'd cry, I'd roll on the floor, I'd pester, I'd annoy you, I'd bother you. Remember? How kind you are. You have already forgotten. But no more. Enough is enough. Now the tables have turned. Today you have come to me asking for happiness, as I once did with you. But today we are armed with unconditional happiness, which is why it's a very different situation today. Because today we have Buddhang Saranang, Dhammang Saranang and Sanghang Saranang Gacchami. We are not anyone's servants. The Buddha did not want servants. Just to give you one example, as he was preparing to pass into Parinibbana, Venerable Ananda asks the Buddha, Venerable Sir, upon your passing away, your body, your holy body will be cremated. And then you will be leaving relics, dhatu. What are we supposed to do with them? So this is the Buddha's chief attendant. For all intents and purposes, you could consider him his servant. Right? So Venerable Ananda asks him, Venerable Sir, upon your passing away and your body being cremated, what are we supposed to do with your relics? And the Buddha says, Ananda, don't you worry about that. The kings and his ministers and the rest of the lay community, they'll come, they'll collect these relics. They will build stupas and pagodas and chaityas and they will put them in there. And they will worship them. They will show their respects to them. But you, my son, he says, I have given you something more than my relics. I have given you the greatest gift a father can give his child. I have given you my legacy. I have given you the Dhamma. So be heedful. Practice diligently. And become an Arahant. Don't worry about my relics. The Buddha did not want servants. Venerable Ananda was given an opportunity because he had resolved many eons ago. He had resolved many eons ago, may I once, the next Buddha arrives, and some occasion when a Buddha arrives, I wish to be the chief attendant. It is what he wanted. He wanted that opportunity because he observed a similar individual. In a previous Buddha's time, attending to the Buddha and earning an abundance of merits and the devotion and the dedication that he had, and he felt a sense of love and affection towards the Buddha, and he wanted to be one like that one day. So he made a resolve. And the Buddha at the time made a prophecy. If that is your wish, and if you have sufficient merits, if you practice the paramitas, then one day you will become the chief attendant to the Buddha Gautama. And some people wonder whether it is because the Buddha uttered that he became the chief attendant. That is not so. The Buddha does not create the future. He does not predict the future. He sees the future as it's supposed to happen, because he looks at cause and effect. If cause and effect determined what happened in the past, if cause and effect determines what happened in the present, tell me what would determine what happens in the future? A crystal ball? Magic? Miracles? What would determine what happens in the future? Cause and effect. So if you have mastered the science and the art and everything there is about cause and effect, then why is it so hard to foretell what happens in the future? If I drop this, is it a miracle if I can predict that it's going to fall on the desk? I mean, would you give me an applause if I told you, when I drop this, it's going to drop on the floor, on the desk, right? See, right? Wait, watch me, right? And if it does, are you going to applaud? Why not? Because you understand the truth about this. You understand that this is physics. But if you didn't understand physics, and if I did that, now that would be, much to your surprise, a miracle. If you had no understanding of physics, if you didn't understand gravity, if you didn't understand the concept of mass and how gravity acts on mass, then it would be a miracle to you. All things are only magic until you get the logic. So when people are so surprised as to how the Buddha could tell the future, they wonder how. It is no surprise. All you have to do is master cause and effect. You and I need not master it to that degree. For us, a bachelor's is enough. You don't need to get a PhD. Because all we need to understand is the cause and effect of suffering. If we can work out the cause and effect of suffering, the product of suffering that occurs in our minds, then we are free from suffering. And that is an Arahant. The only qualification for an Arahant is someone who is free of suffering. Can an Arahant tell the future? We don't know. Some may be able to, some may not be able to. Can an Arahant levitate? Maybe, may not be. Can he go underwater and hold his breath for 3 days? I don't know. Do I care? No. So don't come asking me. I'm not impressed by the supernatural powers and the forces of an arahant. You know what I'm impressed by? The fact that they don't suffer. That's what I'm impressed by. The fact that a mere human being who came into this world crying their eyes out, begging, yearning, longing for anything and everything that they set their eyes on. A mere human being, a mere mortal who wanted everything their eyes could see, who wanted everything their ears could hear, who wanted everything under the sun and the moon, could, after some practice, having instilled the Dhamma within them, become unshakable. It matters not to an arahant if they go blind, they don't suffer. It matters not to an arahant if they go deaf, they don't suffer. If they lose their sense of taste, they don't suffer. Are you prepared for that? What if you lost your sense of taste? I'll give you 3 days of happiness. Volunteer if anyone who's willing to let go of their sense of taste. I'll give you 3 days of happiness. You can't, ladies and gentlemen, because you want the sense of taste. It's very important to you. Because you don't eat food just for the sake of it being food that nourishes your body. You eat food because it's delicious. Just think about the stuff you have in your home right now. Open your fridge mentally. Come on. Yeah, that's the one. That's it. Pull it open. That's right. Yeah, open it. Okay. Now look at the top shelf. Look at the dough. On the dough you have chocolates. Then there's cake. There's a pudding ready for lunch. Yes, you said it last night. It's there now. It'll be ready for you when you head back home. Shall we take a look into the freezer? Just a quick one. I'm only jesting. I love you really. But, the truth be told, what impresses me about an arahant is he's always content. An arahant is a beggar and happy to be one. What's the difference between an arahant and a beggar? That's a good question. What's the difference between an arahant and a beggar? A beggar is a beggar. Because he begs. He's at the mercy of those who are willing to give. But he's not content being one. What about an arahant? Exactly. He's also a beggar. He's just content being one. Like I reminded you last week, God will give you your daily bread. You need not beg. You need not save for tomorrow, because He gives you your daily bread. You need not worry about tomorrow. Worry is not something you do in paradise. In the Garden of Eden, you need not worry. You need not worry. You just have to succumb. You have to surrender. Surrender to Vipaka. An arahant is someone who has surrendered to Vipaka. They're equanimous. Whatever comes, comes. Whatever goes, goes. Come or go? What? Chicago. That's an arahant. I'm trying to paint the picture of my role models in your hearts, because I want them to be your superheroes. It's time for that, ladies and gentlemen. Just because you have a cape over you doesn't make you a superhero. Like, capes don't make superheroes. You've got to look into the heart. You can look at someone's mind and see whether fear looms, anger looms in their hearts, lust looms in their heart, a sense of ego looms in their heart. Always measuring themselves against others. Am I better than him? Am I less than him? Am I richer? Am I more good looking than her? These are the comparisons that always run in people's minds. See, someone who wishes to be good looking is never happy within, unfortunately. Because they're always comparing themselves. I would never wish this upon your daughters. And I don't want you to either. Don't set their bar so low that their life is nothing more than a comparison of how they look against others. Don't set their bar so low. Someone who is beautiful within doesn't compare their looks with another person. They're content. Content at heart is what we need. If you like white, you're only happy when you see white, you're unhappy when you see black. If you like black, you're only happy when you see black, you're unhappy when you see white. But if you like neither black nor white, now you see the beauty in both of them. When you have an image of what beauty is like, you're only happy with half of this world. The other half cannot make you happy. Think about it for a second. I'm spilling out to you something so profound, but in very simple terms. If there's something in this world that you like, you can only ever be happy with half of this world. The other half will always keep you in despair and unhappy. If you like long hair, short hair makes you unhappy. If you like short hair, long hair makes you unhappy. If you like neither, then you see the beauty in both. I'm someone who is able to see the beauty in everything in this world. This is a beautiful world. But to you, perhaps, half of it is beautiful, the other half is ugly. That's why you have a remote control at home. So when you see beauty, you stop. When you see ugly, don't you? And you keep doing that until you see beauty. See, technology is so advanced. It brings you happiness, doesn't it? I don't need this. I don't need that. Because I have found beauty within. So show me anything and I'll be happy with that. Stop showing me anything, I'll be happy with that. Unconditional happiness, that's what we need. So the five precepts. When you're here, and you listen, you hear the Swami Nuhan say, deliver the five precepts to you. Just ask yourself, is this something that my religion forbids me to do? What? Refrain from killing. Is there any religion that promotes killing? Is there any religion that promotes stealing? Is there any religion that promotes sexual misconduct? No. Any religion that promotes lying? Any religion that promotes intoxication? No. Any religion that promotes harm to other sentient beings? No. So am I asking you to do anything that goes against your religion? The answer is no. God and I are friends. Don't you worry. In fact, so much so, let me tell you this. All right? You'll be glad you came in today. If you are really obedient to God, God tries His best to keep you happy. Yes? If you are disobedient to God, then God punishes you. Yes? That's what the books teach. Now here's the deal. I'm always happy. You are sometimes happy. Meaning sometimes God shows you His love, other times God punishes you. Whereas I am always happy. So of the two of us, who do you think is closer to God? Would you like me to repeat the question? If God is the all-knowing, if He is the creator, if He is the master, if He is the scriptwriter, if it is His will and His wish that always happens in this world, if you are obedient to God, God loves you and He always shows you His love and keeps you happy. If you are disobedient to God, God punishes you. Who here likes to be punished? No one likes to be punished. How do you know you're being punished? When you are unhappy, exactly. That's when you know you're being punished, right? Someone gives you cake, a piece of slice, nice slice of chocolate cake. Punishment? Punishment? No, another slice of chocolate cake. Third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, tenth slice of chocolate cake. That's a punishment. Why? Because now you're unhappy. So it's not the chocolate cake that is either reward or punishment. It's your state of mind. Right? If all you had was chocolate cake to eat, would you not go to God and say, "Oh my God, please give me something else. I mean, give me grass, I'll eat it, but not chocolate cake anymore." Right? You'd get on your knees and you'd pray to God asking for something more than chocolate cake. So it's not the chocolate cake that's either reward or punishment. It's your state of mind. So when you're happy, you'll have to admit that that's when God, you're obedient to God and therefore God loves you. God's showing you His love. But when you're unhappy, that's when God's punishing you. Like I said, here's the deal. I'm always happy. I'm never unhappy. You are sometimes happy. Other times you are unhappy. So of the two of us, who is more obedient to God? So, would I preach something against God? If I did, I'd be disobedient to Him. If I did, and if I was disobedient to Him, He would make me unhappy. Am I? I'm not. I don't have half the things that you have, and I'm still happy. So, you see, what God gives is not the material things that you have, because I don't have half of them. I don't have a third of them. I don't have a fifth of them. I don't have a tenth. I even don't have a hundredth of it. I hardly have anything at all, yet I'm happy. You tell me, who experiences God's love more, you or I? And the only thing you need to do to experience the reward, the gift that God gives, and that gift of happiness is to be obedient to Him. That's all. I'm beginning to sound more like a father in the church, aren't I? This is like a church service now. But that's what I said. There can't be two versions of the truth. In the pages of the Bible, I will say, I'll help you see the truth. In the pages of the Holy Quran, I will help you see the truth. Because I am not a Buddhist. I only subscribe to the truth. The truth will set you free. The truth will give you happiness. I am not a religious man. I wear a robe, yes, but I'm not a religious man. I'm not anyone's servant. I'm the servant of the truth. If you want to call that truth God, so be it. If you want to call the truth Buddha, so be it. That's all I am. Many among you may be atheists. Don't you want to be happy though? Okay, you're an atheist. Don't you want to be happy? I mean, you're an atheist, not an a-happy, right? You all want to be happy. So put religion to a side, put God to a side. Let's be happy. As far as I know, this is what God would want me to do. And He has not been punishing me. How do I know? I'm happy. I don't think I would ever be able to be happy against God's will. I speak in these words because I understand that there are non-Buddhists in the audience, and this is a very inclusive environment, and forever it should be so. I am not here to propagate a religion, because I can see what all people do in the name of religion, and I'm not impressed. There are customs that we have to follow. Yes, we do that. So we have a Katina Pinkama. We have Pirit Pinkam. We have the Buddha Puja. We do those things at our monastery. So when I walk in here, you give me some flowers, I lay it down at the altar, and when I worship the Buddha, that's what you see me doing physically. But if you only examine what my mind is doing at that time, I'm just worshipping Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, destination, path and eradication of ignorance and attachment. Buddhism is not a religion. Now don't you say it's a way of life. It's not that either. It's the truth. The truth is everywhere. The problem is when people start to think that they own the truth, right? Jesus belongs to us. He is the Savior and He belongs to us. Don't you ever say that Jesus belongs to you. The moment you say that, you go everything against what Jesus stood for. Then you are asking for punishment. When you say, Allah is mine and no one else's, He's only mine, you're just asking for punishment. You're just asking for condemnation. So the long and short of all that, I mean, that's not what I came to talk to you about today. In fact, I didn't come to talk to you about anything today. I just come because I don't have anything better to do on a Sunday morning. That's not what I came to talk to you about today. But the long and short of all that is, ladies and gentlemen, let's not forget the fact that we are all human beings. If there's any among you who are still worried about what you must do when we observe the precepts, what we must do when the Swami Mahansa walks in, right? Is it okay for me to put my hands together and pay veneration? I mean, what if you were handicapped? You didn't have one of your arms. Now, are you no longer a good Buddhist because you can only do that? You can't do the namaskara with both your hands? Are you no longer a good Buddhist? Some of you, out of such respect, you come up here and say, Swami Mahansa, I'm really sorry, but I've got bad knees. Do you feel a bad Buddhist because you can't get on your knees? If I expect that from you, don't have me in here again. The last thing I want you to do is suffer, physically or mentally. If it's more comfortable for you to be right at the back of the room and just give me a salute like that, then so be it. Whatever makes you happy. If your because it is not a salutation to me, it's a salutation to the truth. That's all. When I get down on my knees, I salute the truth. The Buddha to me is the truth. The path is the path to the truth. That is the Dhamma. The Sangha is my practice. Me walking. Because you need a destination, you need a path, and you need to walk. That's the practice. These are the three things: Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. There you go. metaphorically, now you can get a better sense of it. The destination is Buddha. The path is Dhamma. You walking it is Sangha. Because Sangha is an active thing. You have to do Sangha. You will think that I am a member of the Sangha. Yes, why do you consider me a member of the Sangha? Because I eat your alms food? Why? Because I'm in a robe? No, ladies and gentlemen. Just because you're bald-headed and in a robe does not make you a Sangha. A Sangha is someone, or a member of the Sangha is someone who practices the noble path to get to the destination of Nibbana. That is Sangha. Now the unfortunate thing is you can't tell but just by looking at someone whether they are practicing or not. But it is not our place to judge anyway. God will do that. We leave that in His hands. Let Him judge. Because a guilty conscience needs no accuser. A guilty conscience needs no accuser. If I am guilty of sin, if I am guilty of unwholesome deeds, if I am guilty of hurting, harming, when my last moment comes, there is nowhere I can run and hide. Because my conscience will come forward and say, you have done all these things. It's now time to repent. This is why I don't believe in the concept of punishment in the way that most people like to do. I think I've shared this with you in the past. A good parent, a good teacher should punish, yes, their children, their students, but not in the conventional sense that people think it's right to punish. Because when you punish like that, you just earn demerits. Because you punish out of resentment. You punish because you're angry. At our monastery, we punish. Our punishments have a very different motive. It's not to punish for the deed that has been done. It's to punish so that such a deed does not happen again. A very different kind of punishment and very different kind of intention. See, if you're angry at someone for having done something, say your child does something naughty, you can give them the cane treatment. You can hit them. That is because you're punishing them for what they have done. But if you take a moment to think about why they did that, they didn't do that because they wanted a slap or the cane treatment, right? That's not why they did it. They did it because they wanted something. They wanted something that they couldn't have. They wanted something they shouldn't have. They wanted something that they were not supposed to have. So if they still have that wanting after you've given them the cane treatment, are they not going to do it again? Let's say for argument's sake, your child's taken some money from your wallet. Your child's taken some money from your wallet because he wants to buy something. Now you find out and you punish him. So you bring a ruler or you bring a cane and you hit the poor thing. And you think, right, that should teach you a lesson. If you ever do that again, I'm going to hit you again. You have not really done any good to the child by doing that. You know, that is how you punish animals, because animals can't learn. You can't teach a dog new tricks. But children are human beings and they can learn. If you really love the child, it's not the stick that you need to show them. Show them what was wrong about what they did and how it harms them, not you. Show how it harms them. That is what metta, karuna, mudita and upeksha are. You know, the first lesson of parenting should be the four brahmic abodes. The first lesson that a parent should learn. What metta is, what karuna is, what mudita is and what upeksha is. But that's not what the midwife teaches you, is it? Do you take parental classes before you become parents? How to be a good parent? People will go to prenatal clinics, they'll go to the doctors, they'll read books on good health and good hygiene. But what about the mindset that a good mother, a good father should have so that they can bring a really good child into this world and actually develop that child into a wonderful human being who is free from suffering, screaming at the child does no good to the child, because now what happens is the child is just scared of you. Shouting at the child does no good to the child, because now the only friend that the child had, the child now thinks that I can no longer trust my mother or my father, because when I do something wrong, they scream at me, they yell at me, they shout at me, they hit me, they punish me. These conventional punishments simply goes completely and entirely against our ethos. Now that we understand the Dhamma, we can see, ladies and gentlemen, that this is why such treatment, such punishments can never fix children. If you'd asked me this question 15, 20 years ago, I would have said, yeah, beat the hell out of the child. But not today. I have seen the light. There's no point punishing the body for a sin that the mind has committed. Yes or no? There's no point in punishing the body for a sin that the mind has committed. If it's a sin that the mind has committed, you've got to understand that hurt people hurt people. A mind sins because a mind wants something. A mind that does not want anything does not sin. Don't you agree? A mind that does not desire anything does not sin. So your child nicked that 50 rupees or $5 or whatever from your wallet because there was something he so wanted. He desired it. He thought happiness was in it. That's why he wanted it. He wanted to buy the ice cream. Did I not share with you my story? From when I was younger, I wanted to buy myself a Walkman. And it was only after I'd ordained, I actually told my father. I stole some money from his bag. See, if I told my father back then when I wanted it, he would have said, yeah, Putra, have it, I'll buy the Walkman for you. He would have done that. Or he would have said, right, pass your exams, your upcoming exams, get good results and I'll buy you the Walkman. He would have said that. But I feared what he might say. I thought, well, what if he says no? Because I want it. What if he says no, it's too expensive? What if he says you can't have it? I just couldn't live without it. A Walkman. I couldn't live without it. Is it a surprise later on I decided to get married? I mean, if you can't live with one thing, you can't live with another thing. That's it. Hint, hint. See what the sasana has given me? Freedom. Complete and utter freedom. So when I wanted that Walkman, because I could see my friends, they had Discman, they had Walkman, they had these little fancy MP3 players, they were there at the time. Right? So the cool kids, they had all these gadgets. And I wanted to be a cool kid. I mean, who doesn't? I want to be a cool kid. So there was this Walkman that I wanted. I remember to this day it was 2,300 rupees. Yes, back then. Today what, a loaf of bread is about that much, isn't it? Not a bag of potatoes? I don't know. 2,300 rupees, I remember to this day. So I saved my pocket money. I did that, and if I had continued saving my pocket money, maybe in another 6 months' time, I would have been able to get it. But I couldn't wait. Waiting is the worst thing to do when you want something, right? Who wants to wait when they want something? Waiting and wanting don't go hand in hand. Although they start with the same letter. Those are the two worst things to come together, aren't they? You'd never invite them to a party together, would you? Waiting and wanting? The worst kind of people to have together. But unfortunately, they always come together. So I wanted something and I had to wait for it, and I didn't like waiting because I wanted to be a cool kid, and I wanted to be a cool kid as soon as possible. Because the cool kids were talking about how cool they were and how uncool I was. And it was beginning to bother me. So they were the boys who got the girls' attention as well, because they were cool. See, this is why today we have noble hearts at the monastery. I want to help young children like me. When I was younger, I didn't have noble association. I have a letter I will read to you in just a moment about what noble association has been able to do to one young child who used to sit among you. One little boy who used to sit among you. I think he came from the first to the second or the third sermon or something, and he'd always come and sit with his mother, always paying attention to what Swami Nwanze had to say. He took down notes. He wrote down what Swami Nwanze had to say. He went home and he preached to his mother. He went and he discussed the Dhamma with his grandmother. But this is the noble association I didn't have when I was younger. I had a mother and a father who considered me the apple of their eye. They loved me, every cell in my body. But that's all they could do. As they never had noble association, they couldn't give it to me, because it has to come through the noble lineage. Noble association has to be something that gets passed down one person to the next, one person to the next. Therefore, if today you're getting noble association from someone, somewhere, somehow, rest assured, it all started with the Supreme Buddha. There's nowhere else it can come from. So I wanted, and I didn't like waiting. So what did I do? I went around looking for wherever I could find some cash. And one fine day I noticed that my dad had put some money in his handbag, in his briefcase, and he kept it there for emergencies. So I checked one day, I checked another day, I checked another the following day, and no emergency. The only emergency I felt at that time was my own. There seemed to be no other emergency, so the money was always there in the bag. So one day when they were out, I thought, today's the day. I just can't wait anymore. I remember, well, that was in Maharagama. I used to go to an English class there. I remember there was a Saturday or a Sunday. Every day after class, I would walk into that shop just to check if they still had it. You know, today, as I reflect back on that time, today, I feel like I was a dog on a leash. Every time I walk past that shop, today, I realize that what I'd heard back then was, inju, 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 inju. Hint, hint, okay? Yeah, tummy, 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 tummy. Today I realized that's what I heard. I just couldn't beat the temptation. So I had to turn into the shop. So then, by the second or the third time, the shopkeeper had become used to this. So as I walked in, he'd open the cupboard, he'd pick it up. Yeah, it's still here, sir. Where's the money? So you can imagine, as I was saving my lunch money, I'd starve. See what I'd put myself through? Just for a Walkman? I'd starve myself. See, when the mind wants something, it will sacrifice every physical comfort. That's why when you really want something, it's so easy to get out of bed, isn't it? But when you really don't want it, then what do? You switch off the alarm, you snooze the alarm, you know, getting out of bed is like torture. So I used to always go and ask, how much is it? He said, it's still the same price. I said, can you not give me a discount? I've been coming for like the last 10 weeks. Can you not give me a discount? Just for the virtue of the fact that I've been coming here for the last 10 weeks. He said, yeah, fine. 2,250. So what was 2,300? He gave me a 50 rupees discount. I thought, it's now or never. Went back home. Waited for Dad to leave. And that was my time. You can imagine my heart. It was like a race car. Beating so bad. I think I was 13 years old, something like that. Opened his cupboard, took out the suitcase, put my hand into it, and I grabbed the money. Theft complete. I thought mission accomplished. Now from that point on, I was hoping that no emergency would come to our family. See, I experienced more fear. I think if you take the overall experience of having bought that Walkman, you know, just waiting for it, longing for it, buying it, and then having to always check that there was no emergency and my father didn't actually walk. Every time he walked into that cupboard and took out the suitcase, you know the feeling I was going through? My heart would always skip a beat. That was torture. See, I'd punished myself, hadn't I? Now did I have to wait for God to punish me? No. I'd created my own punishment. But that's the thing. There was something I desired and I didn't know what to do. I had a desire. I had a wanting and there was a waiting and I didn't like the waiting. So I acquired it. It didn't matter to me that it was an unwholesome deed and worst of all, I was committing it against my very own father. I mean, what worse person to commit such an offense against? I was committing it against my own father. This is only one story of many stories among us. Everyone will have a story. You will all have a story. See, the deed was done. The unmeritorious deed had been committed. The sin had been committed. Today we look at it, we reflect and we laugh about it, don't we? I mean, see, we're just having a laugh about it as I relate it. But at that time, that was no laughing matter. It was a sin, no less. It was nothing to laugh about. Back then, when it was done, it was done. If that deed would have come to me at the moment of my death, that would be the end of my human existence for a very long time. It was not just theft, it was theft from one of the two most holy people to me. So if theft of the worst kind. Now don't you see how glad I am that I came across the Dhamma? This is what we didn't have when we were younger. That's why I say, you know, all parents should be taught these fundamentals. So that when they have their children, when they bring a child into this world, they can give them the best that they can. The best that they can afford. The best that they have to offer. On that note, I want to read this letter to you. This is an example of how one mother and father, along with support from their loving family, were able to change the life of a young one forever. Listen to this. Theruvan Sarnai Swamin Vahansa. This letter is something we've been wanting to send for a few weeks now, but was not able to do so as it was really impossible to find the right words, and we apologize for this. We have addressed this letter to you, Swamin Vahansa. So this letter has been addressed to the Swamin Vahansa who looks after our Noble Hearts program. In fact, within Noble Hearts, we have a little thing called Little Britain, as I've mentioned once or twice to you. And in Little Britain, we have a Swamin Vahansa who's in charge of what goes on there, looking after the children, their education, their health, and all that. So this letter is addressed to him. We have addressed this letter to you, Swamin Vahansa, but really it's to the entire community at the monastery. We want to express our sincerest and most heartfelt gratitude for all the love, support and guidance given to us since April, in fact not just April, but since the very beginning when we began associating the monastery. We don't know the names of all those who've helped us along the way, but there were many, including yourself, Swamin Vahansa, the other Swamin Vahansas at Noble Hearts in Little Britain, Anagarika Mahatyas, the Anagarika Mahatmyas, Little Noble Heartians and the devotees. So that includes all of you as well, because you are the community. My son took almost 3 months to settle down. The week before their meditation program was held, because during the school break, so we have a school at the monastery, when we take school break, they do a special meditation program for the children over a number of days. This is about that program. The week before their meditation program was held, we really thought he was going to give up and come home. And we were expecting a call from the monastery asking us to take him home, as it was just not working out. Not working out. How old is Jeff? Not working out. The following weekend, when we saw him, it was as if we were meeting a different child. So over the course of the meditation program, this child had the opportunity to listen to the Dhamma, to practice the Dhamma, to discuss the Dhamma. So at our monastery, even the youngest child, they don't just listen to the Dhamma, they preach the Dhamma. And why do we do that? When you preach, it's far easier to catch where you go wrong, both to the teacher as well as the student. Because when you try and... What is one of the best ways to learn something? It is to teach it, isn't it? Because when you teach, not only you go over material you already know, but also people ask you questions. And you come across areas where you realize, oops, I don't exactly know what this is, and so I don't know how to explain this. I had better go find out. That is why we do that at the monastery. It was amazing to see that transformation. He hasn't cried a single day since or asked to be taken home for a few days. So this child, on I think one or two occasions, he wanted to, and actually he did go home. So asked his parents and he did go home. But then he came back. But our Swamin Vahansa says, the people at the monastery, they were very accommodating. And they always took it at the child's pace. Every time the child went home, whenever he got back, they said, Buddha, it's fine, come back in, whenever you're ready. Because, you know, we understand that this is a life-transforming decision for a child to make. So in the end, he's not asked to go back home. We saw firsthand the power of merits, that the power of merits can transform and can perform miracles. We are so grateful that the meditation program happened when it did, because that is what turned things around. Swamin Vahansa, you may remember how he was constantly asking us to take him to Anuradhapura. This was a request he made day in, day out, right up to the meditation program. Now, I don't think he really wanted to go to Anuradhapura. I think he just wanted to go home. But, you know, young children, when they want things, they'll make up all sorts of stories, won't they? So when you ask to go to Anuradhapura, of course, what parent would object to that? However, just days after the meditation program, while he didn't forget Anuradhapura, his request took quite a different turn. Now listen to this. Instead of him wanting to go, he wanted us both to visit Anuradhapura and visit all of the places of worship. He doesn't show any regret at all that he was not able to go along. Today, we write this letter to you while we are in Anuradhapura. A few days ago was his father's birthday. My son came up with a schedule for both of us for one whole week, a merits week. So now the child is teaching the parents how to practice the path. The student has become the master. That included 3 days in Anuradhapura, which is why we are here today. We have also included the letter and the schedule he gave his father. Following the meditation program, he also gave us a daily schedule to follow, which we faithfully carry out, that includes listening to sermons, chanting Buddha Guna, Arya Maitri and Pirit, Manomaya Pinkam, and other things, all of which he learnt while being there, all because of the noble companionship he receives by being your son, a son of the Sasana. He has become our principal, and we have to report our progress to him at the end of each week. I think this kid is 8. Is a grandmother here? How old? 13. So we have to report our progress to him at the end of each week. While he was settling down, we used to do most of the talking, offering words of encouragement for him to hang in there. Now the tables have turned and he does all the talking, where he gives us instructions and bosses us around and what to do, and all for us to help go forward in our journey to Nibbana. The words Guru Hamdro has said, many times, so this is in Sinhalese, Sasanita Daruek Daya the Kirimeng e Paulotamavena Yahapata, echoes in our minds. This is exactly the situation in our family now. Swami Nuhansa, we wish we can find the right words to express just how grateful we are for all that you do for us. For the first time in our lives, we have found unconditional love, and our hearts really ache when we feel that compassion, kindness, and love. It brings us both joy that our son now has that noble companionship throughout, and that he is among the greatest people who walk this earth. We know that under your guidance and care, he will one day walk in the footsteps of his great teachers. There's nothing more we would want for him. Like all parents, we wanted nothing but give him the best we could. We rest easy now, knowing that we were able to do just that. We thank you, Swami Nuhansa, from the bottom of our hearts. And this is a letter, which you can't see, but I'll read it out to you, written by the child to his father. Listen to this. Dear Tat. No T, I don't know why. Dear Tat. Maybe that's how he calls his father. May this day be a happy and meritorious day for you. May the merits you gain today be able to help you attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. You have to love the rest of this. Listen to this, right? This is a 13-year-old. You have sacrificed a lot on behalf of me, from going in the train to work to spending sleepless nights, working hard to earn money to make my life easier. It's the stuff he learns at Noble Hearts. Because one thing we always talk about is how great our parents are. In fact, we give every child in our care a responsibility. We tell them, Putta, you are the one who has to become a sotapanna and teach the Dhamma to your mother and father and make them sotapannas. That is a responsibility that we give to every child in our care. Don't expect me to do that. You have to do that. However, one thing you did stood over everything else. That is, of course, giving me the gift of Dhamma. This is from a 13-year-old, ladies and gentlemen. We didn't get him to write this. His father sent this to us. We didn't know that he had written this to his father until his father sent it to us. Not only did you give me your well wishes for me to come here, but you did everything in your power to make my coming easy. You even motivated me when I was down. Please keep in mind that I won't be where I am today if it wasn't for you. Thank you, and much merits to you. With lots of love. Here is the schedule that he has prepared for his mother and father. All the things that he has to do when he goes to, when they go to Anuradhapura. August the 3rd, which is a Saturday. So this is what they're supposed to do, and they have to report to their boss on their progress. On August the 3rd, they have to come to the monastery. On August the 4th, you have to come to the monastery and attend the Sila Uvasi program or the special Vas program. Now, there's another story behind this. The parents of this child, they wanted the child to join our monastery because, well, it's obvious now, I think I don't need to explain why, right? They just wanted the best for their child. So when the child first came to us, you know, this is a very loving family. It's a very loving family, very attached to each other. Very strong family bonds. So the child was, he'd grown up in such love and affection in the family that one, you can imagine the hardest thing the child, for the child to do was to let go of his mother and father. So what had to happen for the child to first agree to become or join the monastery, the child demanded that he could see his mother at least once a week. Now they live in Colombo or somewhere around Colombo. So the only way that was going to be possible was if the mother came to the monastery at least once a week. She used to be in this sermon on Sundays. And she was one of them who would sit open, wide eyes, and listen to the sermon right from start to end, taking in every word as if she'd forgotten to blink. There are some among you like that. I wonder sometimes whether you're just frozen or something. I have to come and shake you. You okay? So this was a mother who was so dedicated to the Dhamma, as she'd fallen in love with the Dhamma. But she wanted the best for her son. And then in the end, she decided that she would join the Sila Uvasi program, which happens on a Sunday at the monastery, so that the son would agree to join the Noble Hearts program at the monastery. Because the son demanded that if I'm going to be here, I have to see my mother every week. So that's how it all started. Today, you can't shake him. Today, he doesn't matter whether his mother comes or not. But I remember, so on several occasions, she walked up to me and asked me, "Swami Hansa, I really don't want to miss this sermon, and I don't want to miss this wonderful community that we have here. This is a wonderful bunch of people. I don't know what the Sila Uvasi program is going to be like, but if I don't do that, then my son's not going to join the Noble Hearts program. What should I do?" I said, "Madam, don't worry. Either's fine. Either way, you're going to have Noble Association. So if you're here, you're going to get Noble Association. If you're at the monastery, you're going to get it even more, because here you only have one Swami Nuanze, but at the monastery, you have a whole lot of them. You have the Anagarikas and Anagarikas and everyone looking after you. And besides, if your son's going to join the program, then we can look after him as well." So in the end, that's what she decided to do. So on Sundays now, in fact today as we were being driven out, I saw her walking into the monastery. So she recognizes the car. As she would have done if she were here, I saw her walking into the monastery today. So she can't see me, but I can see her. So she looked at us, and with every ounce of energy that she had in her body, she gave a wonderful veneration towards the car, and I could see the sense of gratitude that she had. I think this I speak on behalf of all of you. The many mothers and the many fathers and the many men, women and children who have come looking for the truth and have found it. But this is one success story of a 13-year-old. A 13-year-old who came from and who still comes from a very loving family, Because, you know, love, these family bonds are some of the strongest bonds and are very difficult to let go of. Just imagine a child, and he's the only child in the family as well. Makes it even harder, doesn't it? But despite all that, what his parents wanted to do was to give him the best thing that they could give in this whole wide world. And that's what they have managed to do. On Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, here's what the parents are supposed to do. Yeah, they're supposed to take a trip to Anuradhapura, and we said Ruvan Velisaya, Sri Mahabodhiya, Thuparamaya, Nirisavatiya, this is like a bus, Jetanaramaya, Abhegiriya, Samadhi Buddha statue, Isurumuniya and Lankaramaya. They're supposed to take pics of them and the Budugay, and show them to me and describe the merits that you did when you were there. And then on the following Thursday and Friday, they're supposed to dedicate these 2 days to do the target list. What I don't have here with me, but on one occasion his mother came and showed me, is there's a list of things that they have to do every day. A list of things they have to do, and they have to tick them off as they do it. And every Sunday when she goes into the monastery, she has to show it to her boss. The student has truly become the master. I tell you one thing, if those parents have not become Sotapannas yet, this child is going to make them one. That much I can tell you. This is how lives have been transformed. This is just one story. We have just over 200 children at the monastery now. Last time I gave you an update, it was 175. Now we have just over 200. Parents who hear these words, they realize that to save their children, the only place they can hide them is in the shelter, is under the cloak of the Noble Triple Gem. Folks, you can't send your child to the best school in the world and protect them. You can't. You can give them the world-class education, but that's where it stops. You can't save them from drugs. You can't save them from evil people. You can't save them from people who are going to put all sorts of rubbish into their heads. You can't save them from people who are going to put all sorts of desires into their heads. It was my best friend at school who showed me the first pornographic picture. My best friend at school. And my parents thought he was such a good friend. You know what they told me? You can invite him round any time, but anyone else you have to first ask us for permission. So one day he came in and he brought with him a diskette. Remember those old floppy disks? That's what he brought with him. And he said, "I have a little gift for you." My best friend. And what did my parents think all the while? That if it is him, it's okay. Right? Because he's a good child, he comes from a good family and all that. They gave me a diskette. And he said, "Look at it after I leave." So he left. And I slid it into the computer. And for the first time in my life, I was looking at something I'd never looked at from a different perspective. I'd only seen my mother like that when she was feeding me. But for the first time in my life, I was expected to look at something in a very different way. I didn't know what to do. First, I didn't know what to do about what I was seeing. Secondly, I didn't know what to do about how I was feeling. I didn't know what to do. Folks, I didn't know what to do about how I was feeling. I didn't know whether it was right or wrong. But I felt my heart beating faster. I felt my palms became sweaty. That I felt. I was feeling uneasy. I didn't know what to do though. I didn't know whether I was supposed to go and ask my mother or father what to do with this. Because he told me, don't show anyone. He said, if you need more, just give me a call. How can you save your children? Well, there's one way to save them. Blindfold them. Put, earplugs into their ears. Hogtie them. And put them in a cave somewhere in the middle of a desert. That way you can save them. Until they die. But then that would not be a life at all. You can't let them live and love them at the same time, unfortunately. The more freedom you give them, the more freedom you take away from them. Read between the lines and you'll understand what I mean. The more freedom you give them, the more freedom you take away from them. Because the more freedom you give them, the more you expose them to everything that's going on around them. And the less freedom they have to choose how they feel. They'll no longer be free from desire. Because when desire strikes, it is not they who decide what to do. Desire decides. When anger takes over, it's not you who decides what to do. Is it? What decides? Anger decides. Isn't that why you later regret? And you say, I don't know what took over me. You say these things. See? That was when I was in grade 6. First time in my life I'd seen that. You think I stopped the following day? No, the heart wanted it. The mind desired it. See, these are the stories that you would never tell anyone. Because you have a reputation to keep. You have to look the part, right? Because you are a manager. You are a doctor. You are an engineer. You are a very respected individual in society. You are a teacher. You can't share these stories with other people. You can't show them how ugly it is within you. But this is the story. This is the story of everyone. Everyone's stories. And then until I came across the Dhamma, because I was indoctrinated at the time, because I thought that is what a female person is for, to enjoy. I could no longer. From then on, I saw a difference between my mother and every other woman. I saw a difference. When there is not supposed to be a difference. But my sight had been changed forever. It had been changed for good. Until the day I would come across the Dhamma, and wrong view could be rectified to right view again. Until such time, I would always see my mother and all the other women in the world. Does this ring a bell? Gents? Ladies? Ring a bell? Have you heard a similar story before? Or read it in a book? Such is the story of our life. C'est la vie. This is why Buddham, Dhammam, Sangham, Saranam Gacchami. See, these children, they're being healed. If this child has never seen pornography in his life before, at 13 years of age, he will never from here on. That guarantee. And what's better, he will not want to. There will be a day in his life where you can show him a picture of a naked woman and he would see no difference between that and his own mother and any other formation of Rupa. Because now he's in the association of noble ones. That is the Sambuddha Sasana. And what's more, he's now guiding his parents. See, what I'm doing at age, 36, he's now doing with his parents at only 13. How much merits do you think he's earning by doing that? Does your child come up to you and ask you if you've gone, if you worship the Buddha or offered flowers? Does your child come up and ask you that? Or does he ask you, where's that bicycle you promised me? Where's my PlayStation? Can I have a reload on my phone, please? Can I have some cash, please? Where's my pocket money? Isn't that what children ask their parents? Amma, I want this. Appachi, I want this. Tati, I want that. Do they come and ask you, Amma, I want you to come to the Sila Vasi program and listen to the Dhamma and come and explain to me what you've heard? Don't you think this is an extraordinary life now? How young should you be, or how old should you be to become extraordinary? There's no age. It's how fortunate should you be. You just need to be fortunate enough to come across noble association. So while it's still there, ladies and gentlemen, make use of it. Please, introduce the Dhamma to your children. I know many of you have, and I have deep respect for all of you that have. I know sometimes some of your children are abroad. They've gone there for education, for studies, further studies, whatever. But whenever they come down, I know some fathers, some mothers here in the audience, they make it a point to bring them in here. I know some of you make promises to your children, right? Putta, I'll give you that, but you have to come to the Sunday sermon. It's changed from Putta, I'll give you that if you get good grades in your exams, to Putta, I'll give you that if you come to the Sunday sermon. Remarkable. Remarkable. Amazing. If you really love, that's what you should do. True love is love where the love that you give helps them become indispensable. They become invincible. They become invincible. Unshakable. You have to teach your children how to be happy with or without you. With or without the bicycle that they're asking for. With or without the cheesecake they're asking for. With or without the KFC they're asking for. With or without the Burger King they're asking for. You give them what they want, that's fine. But also give them what they need. But because they may not come to you asking for that, because they don't know what they need, they only know what they want. But as responsible parents and teachers, we need to know what our children need. And we have to give them that. Mustn't we? Mustn't we? Isn't that why we are entrusted as adults, parents, teachers? Isn't that why young children look up to us and we look down at them? Aren't we supposed to know what they need more than what they actually want? So let's make sure we give them that. And the same applies for you as well, ladies and gentlemen. You know, in the same breath I ask you to do what you can for your children, I'll also ask you to do what is right for you. Fulfilling your duties and responsibilities, all that is great. But remember, at the end of the day, all you have is yourself and the Dhamma. There's a nice stanza. Dhammang vinaya, Dhammang vina natti pita cha mata. Dhammang vina natti pita cha mata. Besides the Dhamma, there is no mother or father. Tameva tanam, saranam patitta. It is only the Dhamma itself that will be your protection, that will be your refuge, and that will be your foundation. Tasmahi bho. Kiccha manya pahaya. Tasmahi bho kiccha manya pahaya. Meaning, set aside all these irrelevant activities, things that are not conducive to your practice, to your salvation, to your happiness. Set them aside. Set them aside. These are not my words. You will know the last line of this. You've heard this before. But you may not have heard the first three, which is what I just related to you. And the last line goes, Sunata Dharet Charata Dhamme. You've heard that before, haven't you? Dhammang vina nati pitacha mata. Besides the Dhamma, there is no mother or father. What that means is, although you think that it is your mother and father that loves you, protects you, guides you, safeguards you, it is not them, it is the Dhamma. It is the Dhamma that protects you. Dhammo have rakkati dhammachari. You've heard these words before. It is your protection, it is your refuge, it is your foundation in happiness. So, set aside all these useless, nonsensical, futile activities that you're engaged in. This is not me saying, this is the meaning of the stanza. Set aside all these futile, useless, meaningless, building the world and all these activities that go hand in hand with that. Put it all aside and do what? Sunata. Listen. Dhareta. Bear. Charata. Practice. Dhamme. The Dhamma. Because that is what a human life is for. That is what a human life is for. Once again, that is what a human life is for. Sunata dhareta charata dhamme. I know it's difficult, ladies and gentlemen. The other day I was thinking to myself, sometimes I perhaps come across as too, I don't know what the word is, too demanding on you. Sometimes I might be asking you to do things that are actually unreasonable. To ask from an audience who are deeply rooted in lay responsibilities and a lay livelihood. I understand that. Because I think in this room are people who are responsible for maybe half the country and how the country operates, the economy, the business, commerce and all that. Perhaps if all of you came to the monastery today and ordained yourselves, then we'd have to go for a general election again. Or maybe they'd have to rewrite the whole constitution. I know, I know who you are. I don't know you individually. I don't know any of you individually. Except maybe if you've helped organize the sermon and we've had to have discussions and chats. Otherwise, I don't know any of you individually. And that's okay, I like that. Because then I can talk to you freely. Because then none of these words are intended to hurt you. Because if I knew each of your stories individually, it makes giving the sermon very difficult. Now it does. Let's just say I knew that one of your children eloped with someone. Say your daughter ran away with someone. And if I knew that story, and if I start to give a sermon, and now I have to talk about a girl running away with a boy, now I have to think about how that might impact you. Whether those words might hurt you. Now at the start, we started talking about how if someone's got a terminal illness, how that might affect someone. And if I knew each of you and all your stories, then I might have to think, well, what if this hurts them? Then I'll have to filter a lot of what I'm saying. And then this would not be a sermon at all. So, in some ways I'm glad that I don't know your personal stories, and that's okay, let's keep it that way. I don't mean, of course, any disrespect. But it also gives me the liberty to talk to you freely and share with you the truth without tempering it. But then at the same time, I have to remind myself that you are very deeply rooted in your responsibilities and everything that you have to do, that sometimes maybe I come across as too demanding. I need you to know that I only mean it in the best of intentions. I know that it's difficult. It took me 28 long years to finally receive the Dhamma and make the jump. Some of you may have educational commitments that you have to make. Maybe you need it, maybe your parents want it of you, and you have no way of saying no to them. Maybe your parents are looking to get you married off. Maybe you don't want it, but you just can't say no to your mother because she says, you do that and I'm going to jump onto the train. Or jump under the train. Maybe. I don't know, because I don't know your individual circumstances. But here's what I do know, that getting married is not going to give you happiness. That you can't deny. Here's something else I also know. Your master's, your PhD, your double PhD is not going to give you happiness. That I know. But your mother doesn't know that yet. So she thinks your PhD is going to make her happy. So that's what she wants you to do. It's a case of the blind leading the blind. I know the problems that you have, not individually, but generally, because I didn't fall from the sky. I'm a living, breathing human being just as you are, so I know the issues and the turmoils that go through in your lives, but at the same time, I'll keep saying what I have to say. I just need you to know that I'm not attacking anyone, I'm not making unreasonable demands of anyone. I'm just saying, whenever it's possible for you, do it. Okay, so I'm not going to say, like, there's the bus outside, everyone go, get into the bus, we are going to the monastery. No, I won't say that. I won't say that. But I'll bring the bus here every day. Okay, I'll bring the bus here every day. And whenever you're ready, you get onto it. Is that okay? So if I came across as too demanding, I apologize. It was not intended to be so. I only want the best for you. Because I know that time and tide waits for no man. You and I are here today. This might be our last meeting. So I just want you to be heedful as much as you can. Maybe Sunday mornings is all you can commit to. Because the rest of the time you are feeding your family, you are taking your children to school, right? You have to do their homework with them. At the same time, you're doing some part-time study. Maybe you're doing a second job. Maybe you've just done you have to do work overnights as well. Maybe you have a sick mother who you have to look after. I don't know all of these stories. So really, you know, from that perspective, it's unfair for me to say, right, what the hell are you doing? Let's go. Then who's going to do all that? Are you going to pick up all that? Right, fair enough. Right, I understand. You even have to feed the dog, right, when you get back home. See, that's also another responsibility. I understand. At least I have to understand. And then you have work. Some of you may be running businesses of your own that you started from nothing. And you know, you've built it up, and today it's an empire. And you can't just you know, throw it at someone and come. It's a reputation that you stand for. You know, you are seen to be the founding father of that organization, so you can't just throw it like an old hat and come with me. I understand that. I mean, it took me a while to release myself from my responsibilities, but perhaps my responsibilities were different to yours. But you know, whatever circumstances we are in, the truth is the truth. As long as we agree on that, that we all have to die, and that when we die, we leave with nothing more than what we came in here with. Yeah? So your most beloved husband is not going to come with you. All your feeding, looking after, keeping him happy is only going to be as long as you're alive, or he's with you. Your children are not going to come with you.
All the property that you've acquired, you've built, is none of that you're going to take with you. All you're going to take with you is the merits and the demerits you have done and the understanding of the Dhamma. The irony of it is that to which you dedicate the least amount of time in your busy schedules. That's the irony. The only thing you can take with you is the Dhamma you have understood, and the merits and the demerits that you have done. But the most of your time is spent doing a lot of the other work, and very little time towards that. What typically tends to happen is when people grow older and then they become that discarded tissue paper of society. You take it, you wipe your hand, and you throw it in the trash, discarded. Once you become discarded, a discarded member of society, I used a nice word the other day, I'm not going to say it again. When you become one of those, then you realize, good gosh, no one wants me anymore in their lives. No one's inviting me to the parties. No one's inviting me to dinner outs. No one's inviting me to high tea. What can I do now? My children don't want me. They have a life of their own. My grandchildren won't even talk to me. What makes them happy doesn't make me happy for some reason. What makes me happy doesn't... They don't want the stories. I try to tell them fairy tales and they're not happy about that. They just want to go and play their computer games. And I don't know how to even switch on the computer. So I have become irrelevant. When that happens, you look for refuge. Right? Just like an asylum seeker. Then you look for refuge. And when you look for refuge, then you realize that in the village temple, they have a poya program every poya day. This is what happens to most elderly people in our country. So on poya days, you go to the temple and you see a bunch of achyammas and siyas come in and sat around the Dhamma hall with their backs to the wall doing what? Don't laugh. It's so Swaminas is doing a numeracy lesson. He says 1, 2, 3. So Swaminas is teaching them how to count. That's what happens. Because all the good life and vitality that they have within them was drained. Year after year after year, year on year, it was drained, pumping into enriching society. The world, children, grandchildren, business, the mortgage, the car. Remember last week? All that. And what you have left now is just a little bit of energy that's just keeping you afloat. That's all. Then you just become a very dimly lit candle. Just bright enough so that you can survive. So just people know that you are there. That's all. That's all. Then you become irrelevant. You become insignificant. And then the only refuge is the Mahasangha. Nobody wants you. And in fact, then poya days, it becomes a convenience for the rest of your family. Because that's the day they can travel. How so? They can pick you up and drop you at the temple. And then they can go on a trip. So why do we have poya days? You know the answer. We have poya days not so that young people who are full of life and energy can go and practice the Dhamma, sunata dharita charata dhamma. That's not what it is for. It is so that when parents and old people become an inconvenience, they can be left to be looked after by the Swaminarayanas and the Dayakyas of the temple because they give them a free lunch. Right? And they'll just be there until evening and then they just have to come and collect them. And then the children are happy because they feel like, see, my mother is very virtuous. She's so virtuous. Every poya day, we take her to the temple, and when she's there, she offers flowers, she listens to the sermons, that's what she thinks. She doesn't listen to the sermon, she sleeps through the sermon. That's what she does. I mean, you know, listening to the sermon helps you to attain Nibbana. Sleeping through a sermon doesn't help you do that. Trust me, it doesn't. You know, you have physical bodies, don't forget that. These are human bodies.
These bodies will only function for as long as there's ample energy within them. And it's draining away from you every day. Every day. You are not as young as you were last week. You are not as young as you were yesterday. You are not as young as you were at the start of this sermon. You have aged. Tomorrow, you'll be older than you are today. Surprise. So, I mean, that's all I really want to say. I just care about you, that's all, folks. But I do apologize if I come across as too demanding. It is not intended to push or, you know, push your buttons or to hurt you or anything like that. I just know that time's ticking for all of us. Right. Now, next week, the plan was to invite a certain someone. But that has changed slightly. Because on the 1st of September, we don't have use of these premises because the school has some exams that they have to conduct. And so for the 1st of September, which is in two Sundays on from today, the sermon will be held at the monastery. Now, I know that this is a little bit of an inconvenience because you'll have to travel there, and I do apologize for that. That's all. I mean, unfortunately, that is the best I can do. However, if you make it to the monastery, I'll make it worthwhile. That I can promise you. So I'll make sure you get a lunch. Right? So I promise you. Two Swaminas. So you get to the monastery. We are planning a program for you, like we did once. So in the morning, there's going to be, this is the rough plan. We're still working out the details, so a little bit might change. In the morning, you'll have a precept, then you'll have a Sila Bhavana program for the day. And what's really good is now we have a Valimalu at the monastery, which is available for, well, actually, we have three Valimaluas. Ample room for all of us to use. And the plan is, in the morning you have a sermon to introduce you to the program and what we are going to be reflecting on practicing for the course of the week, for the day. Then in the afternoon, we'll stop for lunch, do the Buddha Puja and all that. And then we have the Valimaluva, and you'll have a reasonably long period of time to practice. And what I'm planning on doing is, over the next 2 weeks, give you a decent amount of Dhamma, so you know what to practice when you get to the Valimaluva. So the last few weeks we've been talking about this, that and the other and everything. A lot of different things. But over the next couple of weeks, I want to focus on Anicca, Dukkha and Anatta. So when you get to the Valimaluva, you know what to do. And you're not just pacing up and down, counting your footsteps. Right? Because that is pointless. So that we can do. And then at the end of that Valimaluva period, I'm going to get Guru Andhru to talk to you. So we are still working out whether that's going to be the morning sermon or the afternoon sermon. But one of these two, he has promised to do. And so if you can make it to the monastery on that Sunday, then I think it will really be worth your while. For those who would like to have a counseling session, like we once did when you visited. Now the only challenge with Sundays now is, Sundays have become very busy because there are young children who demand their mothers to come and join the Sila Vesi programs and so on, right? So it's become very busy now. By which I mean most of our Swaminas are occupied. And we also have a separate meditation program that runs in the monastery throughout the course of the Rains Retreat program. So, but I still have hope that if we have a few of you, we might still be able to organize some one-on-one sessions in case you have specific problems that you would like to discuss with the Swaminuhase or an Anagarika Mahatmya and get clarified. So what we'll do next week is I'll put a piece of paper out there and would request you to put in your name and what medium and whether, well, if you like a one-on-one session, just to put your name on that. I may not be able to cater to all requests simply because of the fact that we have a busy program this time round, but we will try our best to do as many of them as possible. And that will happen
probably at the same time as your Velimaduva time. So you can either be in the Velimaduva, or if you need some extra help, you want to discuss a particular problem with someone and just get something off your chest maybe, or maybe it's just to get some advice on how you can better organize yourself so that you can one day come into the sasana, if that is perhaps what's on your mind. So that will be a time for you to have a heart-to-heart and arrange something like that. So this is what I have in mind for the time being. Next week I'll fill you in on more of the details. So that's on the 1st September, which is a Sunday. Now, which also means these poor people, they don't get to do the alms round because it's the first Sunday of the month. I don't know how you plan that. Every first Sunday of the month, something or the other goes wrong. Two months ago, it was rain. Not yet. Last week, the months before. Only last week we had a chance, but then again on September, now things are changing again. But anyhow, perhaps they just don't have enough merits yet. So next week will be the usual program, and of course we'll have a guest. Who's that? Mr. Daniel. So he will no longer be Mr. Daniel on Sunday. And quite a few of you I know will be looking forward to come to the monastery for his ordination, which is on Saturday. So once again, you're all welcome. So he's going to be our first foreign monk. There are some monks who are of dual nationality, but he's the only monk who's completely foreign. So our first foreign monk. And I don't think he'll stay with us for very long. Not because of anything else, but we'd want him to take the Dhamma to all over the world, certainly to his people. Because what I've asked him to bring me is one more German. I said, if you want to repay the debts that you believe you owe me, only one thing I want from you, bring me another German. He said, yes, Swaminas, I'll do that. So that's his task, to bring another German. Gentleman or lady, I don't mind. I don't mind. Right, shall we call it today? You've been sending me a few questions and I'll pick them up. So the next couple of weeks, we'll focus our discussions on the Dhamma, particularly in preparation for the 1st September program. All right. Let us all take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired by listening to the Dhamma, inviting the Swaminarayanas to deliver the sermon, and creating a conducive environment for all to come along and practice the path in peace and harmony. First and foremost, let us take a moment to transfer these merits to all the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to the Mahanayakas, the Anunayakas, as well as all the other monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries, who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer this message to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer this message to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in this merit. Let us also transfer these merits to our devotees and friends of the monastery, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes anyone and everyone who provides the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who provide the Mahasangha with, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcoming obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins and nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, and our teachers, as well as those who've gone the extra mile on our behalf, who've left no stone unturned, to help make our lives better and happier. May they all rejoice in this medicine. By the power of these medicines, may they also be freed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfilling and preserving the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who passed away in our names, our forefathers, our ancestors, our loved ones, reminding ourselves that in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life and practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us transfer these merits to all of them. Let us also transfer these merits to those who lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe, as well as members of the armed forces, as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation. Let us transfer these merits to those who have lost their life in natural disasters and calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, friends and acquaintances to us. They will have helped us, supported us and assisted us in many ways, shapes and forms. And out of gratitude and a sense of loving kindness and compassion towards all of them, let us transfer all of the merits that we have acquired to all. May by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful planes, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I and everyone who's helped make this program a success become a Rahatan Vahanse or an Arhatiranin Vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. Sabda Papa Sakaranam Kusalasa Upasampada Sachitta Pariyodapanam Etang Buddhana Sasanam.